Welcome to Creator Coco. This podcast helps you become a better creator by helping you learn from what other creators have already figured out. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us a tweet at Creator Coco. That's Creator and then C-O-C-O-A. In this episode, I talk to Chris Munialo about the history of the S&P 500 and how index funds work in general. I hope you learn something that helps you become a better creator. So for this talk, I wanted us to talk about the S&P 500. It's this index fund that's touted as a good way for you to invest. Like, if you want to invest in stocks, people are saying you should always at least have some exposure to the S&P 500. So I don't know whether you have experience with the S&P 500 or how much you've been involved with it.
Well, I've been reading quite a lot about stocks. I have quite a number of investments in individual stocks. But generally, the research I've been trying to read about is the whole concept of whenever you want to invest, you don't know what the market will be in the next few years. So basically, the prices are determined by the market and you can't accurately predict what it will be. But generally, the whole index or the whole market value rises over some certain period of time. I think the famous saying is time in the market is better than time. You know, like, you can't beat the market, but if you are there in a long time, that's how I got to know the index funds. At the moment, I haven't invested in any of them, but I just have individual stocks.
Oh, okay. And that's actually, you've explained very well the objective basically of investing and trying to find all these different stocks and trying to diversify. So that if one part of your portfolio loses value, there's another, it's completely separate from a different part. And something like the S&P 500, for example, has returned over the last 100 years 10% or 10.5%. So if you have your money there, it's like considered to be a solid way of slowly growing your money. It's even touted, or you, like, if you think 100 years, it's a long time. That means it went through things like World War II or even the Cold War. But I recently learned a bit more about how index funds started and how they became popular in our culture. And that's actually what I wanted to dive in, because I don't think that they are exactly what I thought they were. Because if you're told, for example, it's the S&P 500, it's almost like betting on America. If America rises, it's very likely that the top 500 companies are going to be somehow involved in that. And you're going to share basically in the spoils of the growth of this country called America. But let me talk about now a bit of history of how the something like the S&P 500 started. And it started just the same way you've mentioned it right now, which is if you want to invest, you have to go and buy individual stocks. So before the before 1976, basically the S&P 500 was just an indicator. So it's just like a number that people, it was a theoretical thing. If you wanted to actually invest in the S&P 500, you had to go and buy 500 individual stocks before. And this thing that we now call the S&P 500, it only started in 1976, basically. So in the last few years, that's when the first index funds became available to retail investors. And before that, as I said, it was just an indicator. And the funny thing is that when the S&P 500 first launched as an actual index fund, it wasn't as popular as we would have thought. Oh, this is an index fund, it's been returning this much. It still wasn't that popular because the fancy investors, or the people who, you know, they actively manage their funds, were looking down on index funds as a way for unsophisticated retail investors to get into the market. So they were sneering at the idea of an index fund, and it was associated with people who couldn't even beat the market. And these active funds, like actively managing your fund, was thought to be superior. So have I said anything there that's interesting so far in the history of these index funds?
Very important. The whole concept of fund managers who, for the longest time, you know, they are professional people who have studied this and they can do the technical analysis and whatever. So these guys, they get paid a percentage of the returns. So basically, the issue here is whenever you've invested in a fund manager, you are somehow guaranteed, because they are professionals, that you will get more returns. And then they get to pick the stocks for you because they have the time to do that. So that's why people are going to the fund managers. Then I think some argue that these guys are not really doing much because you really can't predict the market. And if you're just to passively manage those funds by having an index, which is theoretically all the stocks that are there in the market, you could actually beat those hedge funds. So I think that's came about, and it actually makes sense if you know you don't have all the time to actively manage the stocks.
Yeah, and you've just mentioned something there that's quite important, like this competition between hedge funds and index funds. And that leads us to the next part of the history of these index funds. So after they're launched, like in the 70s, like, so you realize, first of all, that 100 years, it's not the real 100 years. It's basically much shorter than that, that index funds have been popular. And then, there were a couple of periods when index funds came out on top, basically, of the hedge funds, as you've just mentioned, or even some tech stocks. And that the first time was in the dot-com crash. So in the dot-com crash, when every tech stock was crashing, the S&P 500 held up compared to some of these other tech stocks. And if you had invested in the S&P 500 during the dot-com crash, you'd have lost probably 50% when the tech stocks were losing up to 80% at that time. And the next time is this, okay, did it happen? Oh, yeah. The next time, you've just mentioned it, the hedge funds. Warren Buffett made a bet with, I don't know, some other rich guy for, I think, $1 million, that that his index fund, basically, if he invests in the S&P 500, it would beat the hedge funds or something like that. I think that's how it went. And when you think about it, that's one of the few famous stories about index funds. And the truth is, in this short history of index funds that has existed, it's only in the last like a couple of decades, like the last 20 years, that people started looking at index funds as a real way to invest. Now let's talk about what is actually in these index funds. So we've talked about passive investing. You've just mentioned that sometimes investors don't have time to actually go out and actively invest in every stock that they want. But the funny thing is that when the S&P 500 started, when you think about it, this list of 500 companies is mostly the list of the 500 companies that the active managers are choosing to invest in. So technically, if you are investing in an index fund, at least in the beginning, you are just investing in what the active investors were thinking was popular. So it's not necessarily reality, or it's not necessarily completely disconnected from active managers. It's just that you're aggregating the decisions that all these different active managers had. So if the active managers think that they like Coca-Cola and Coca-Cola rises up in the ranks, it enters the S&P 500, you're basically you're voting with these active investors. And I thought that was a very interesting idea. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think when it There are quite a number of them. So, like the S&P 500 is one of them where these guys have come up with the list of the 500 companies. So, I think it depends on what kind of value you're expecting. So, for example, you could be interested in getting capturing those 500 companies in the US, or you could want something else. For example, you just want funds which have are involved in, or you want funds which are invested in, I say, pharmaceuticals, for example, when COVID came, or you want funds which are invested in maybe the future of transport or green energy. So when it comes to the specifics of the investor, it depends on what value you are seeking. If it's just general, then I think S&P 500 is one of the best you can go for. But if you have interest in other kinds of stock or investments, you can also go into other kind of index funds which can suit your need.
Yes, and there's a couple of other index funds we can talk about, like even the okay, so there's a couple, there's even a variant of the S&P 500 that's called the let me check my okay, that's called the S&P 100. There's also the NASDAQ 500. Okay, so that being said, so the point I was making about index funds being a conglomeration basically of what active investors are thinking about. Nowadays, that has changed a bit. So like you've said, people sometimes don't have time for this. So they usually set you set an order basically that you can be purchasing these things or these investments or these stocks. Maybe once every month. So you just close your eyes and you're blindly investing into something called the S&P 500. And what I've learned is that that is creating buying pressure. So it says, it means that simply because a company is in this S&P 500, because people are not actually looking at what's in the S&P 500, they're buying and selling things which they don't completely understand. And if something is in the S&P 500, it gets bought way more than it probably would deserve to if it wasn't in the S&P 500. Like if Apple wasn't in the S&P 500, would it be worth 2 trillion instead of 3 trillion? Or, you know, so just because companies get into the S&P 500, it creates a situation where the assets get inflated. So people just buy you because you're in the S&P 500. And what that leads to is the companies which are not performing well, they end up lasting much longer in this index fund. And the companies which are performing well even at the bottom, they don't end up entering the S&P 500 because these are the companies, it's not easy for the companies in the S&P 500 to move. And even funnier is that let me read this. So 90% of stocks on the S&P 500, oh, sorry, for 90% of the stocks on the S&P 500, the largest shareholder is an index provider. So for 90% of all the stocks which you find on the S&P 500, so basically for 490 something, I don't know, out of 500 companies on the S&P 500, all of them, the largest shareholder is an index fund. So that gives you an idea of how much pressure there is. If you get in the S&P 500, people just buy you for no reason. Like people are not looking at your fundamentals as a business. And it gets even more interesting. So when you think about S&P 500 and you think I'm investing in 500 different companies, the funny thing is that these 500 companies are not weighted equally. So for example, Apple makes up 7% of these 500 companies' contribution to the S&P 500, to the returns. and the top 50 companies contribute 50%. So out of 500, 50 companies will give you 50% of the returns. That means 450 companies are just doing nothing or not doing that much. They're doing 50%. To make it even worse, it turns out that if you just buy Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, those have given 40% of the returns of the S&P 500 in the last 5 years. So 1% of stocks on the S&P 500 contribute 40% of the returns. And that just means it's a weird thing. Like, it doesn't seem like it's as diversified as you would think, because if you look into it, it seems like only five companies are contributing 40% of the returns. So would you be better off with a different investment? Okay. I still think you should invest in the S&P 500. Eventually, I think we'll talk about that later, but, I just wanted to highlight to you that, 1% of companies on the S&P 500 give 40% of the returns. What do you think about that?
I think just taking a step back and looking at why the fund exists, it's kind of the goal, as you mentioned at the start, was just to a portfolio that gives you exposure to the whole U.S. stock market. And as we know, the whole of the U.S. stock market is dominated by a few companies like, you know, Apple, Google, Tesla. So these few companies actually dominate the stock market. And if this fund, you know, gives you exposure to the entire of the U.S. stock market, then it makes sense for those stocks included in the fund to be weighed against the companies which dominate the market. So basically, you know, to be weighed against how much value each company gives to the value of the entire stock market.
Yes, and to add on to that, there are also different kinds of stocks. So apart from relying only on the S&P 500, it's just that this S&P 500 is the famous one. People always talk about the S&P 500, but there are other ways to aggregate, as you're mentioning, your risk, basically, or to diversify your risk. And I just wanted to also add a couple of other funds which you might be interested in checking out. So there's one called the S&P 100, and it turns out that 98% of the returns from the S&P 500 come from 100 of the companies. So if you take the S&P 100, that's also one you can use, and it's not that different from the S&P 500. They're pretty much identical, because the top companies of the S&P 100, these are the top 100 companies, they determine also the S&P 500 as well. There's also another one called NASDAQ. So NASDAQ is much more tech focused. And the cool thing about NASDAQ, and I see not many people talking about it, okay, at least compared to the S&P 500 as an investment tool, NASDAQ has more risk because it has all these tech stocks. But the NASDAQ has performed five times better than the S&P 500. So if you're looking for a bit more risk, you can also check out the NASDAQ. Some of these you can also buy as tokenized stocks on FTX or something like that online. And what else? Is there any other index fund? Yeah, so NASDAQ, you can try S&P 100, you can try NASDAQ. And you can also tell me about your investment strategy. But mine in general is to invest in a few tech stocks that I'm interested in, or a few companies which I've heard of that are interesting. Some of them, probably you should always invest in the top five or so companies on the S&P 500, plus a bit of Bitcoin and also Ethereum. That's the general idea. So what do you think about that investment strategy? And how do you usually decide how do you usually decide how to invest and things like that?
So I think
your strategy works, because if you have exposure to the S&P 500 and a few tech stocks which you deem as high growth stocks, then definitely you're guaranteed if there is going to be a lot of growth in value of the stocks, you will also get to have an increase in value over time, based on the few stocks that you've picked. And if you have market, you have a recession or depression as is right now, you also don't suffer a lot because of your exposure to the S&P 500. So I think in a way, the S&P 500 or an index of funds helps cushion you when the market is not doing so well. So an example is, we know when Elon Musk said that they'd be laying off some of their staff, then Tesla and the prices fell sharply. And then the same happened this year, Netflix, they released their earnings, Facebook. So these tech stocks tend to increase in value when everyone is optimistic. But then when things start going south, those are the first that people ditch. People tend to go to stocks for companies which are traditional and actually provide real value and not so much speculative. So I think that having a balance of crypto is also at the moment speculative, so it helps to, it's important to have it in the long run, but when things go bad, it's one of those which lose a lot of value instantly. So just having a balance of those really helps. And I think personally, I have the same strategy where I just tend to balance between high risk and low risk investments. So high risk being crypto, and then low risk being the index funds. But at the moment, I don't have index funds, but I am exposed to a wide range of stocks, which I feel in the long run would actually be more, would actually lead to more generational value. So would I invest in S&P 500? Yeah, definitely I would. Though I'd prefer to go to a specific market segment or industry, I would actually start with that before going to S&P 500. So, yeah, I think I would actually have something maybe on funds which are related to the health sector, and a bit on industries, and a bit on energy. So I think that is my MBM strategy.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. And you're right that tech stocks are usually the first ones to be ditched because tech usually doesn't tech companies sometimes don't make money, but then they are still overvalued. And so when the crash comes, people are usually like, these companies barely make any money and they don't give any value to the real world yet. So these are the first ones they're gonna ditch. That being said, there's also you've mentioned this crash or this downturn that we're having currently, and I wanted to say something about it. Oh yes, and it's actually interesting. I'm starting to realize, or I should have realized, or I always knew, I don't know, that the downturn we're having now is related to the upswing that companies had during COVID. So when COVID happened, a lot of tech stocks shot up, and a lot of companies became highly overvalued. And now what's happening is, I think pretty much it's the market correcting itself, and that we are now heading towards a more normal situation than it being that it was normal and now it's bad. I feel like more and more people are starting to say that this is more of a recalibration of the market after the boom of the pandemic and the US government giving a stimulus package to the citizens. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think over time, stocks tend to find their true price. But I think sometimes it's just the market sentiment which could punish some of the stocks. So definitely, whenever we have a bull run, companies tend to be overvalued, and then it's normal that when there is a bear market, now everything corrects itself and we kind of start afresh. So that makes sense. Though in some cases, people just try to punish companies, though I wouldn't say that's the case right now, because people are less very speculative, and it's all about the current sentiments. So if people feel like, for example, Netflix is going to start charging customers who are sharing passwords, and then that might lead to reduction in revenues, it's natural that they are going to pull out the investments from there.
Okay, yeah, you're right about that. And I had something else to add. Oh, yes. And one of the things that happens now when something like that happens, when stocks become cheaper, when things start going down, is that some investors who believe that the price is low at that moment start investing. For example, when the value of Netflix dropped, an investor called Bill Ackman invested, I think $1 billion or something like that into Netflix, because he at the time thought that Netflix was now undervalued, and if he bought it at that price, he would end up making a lot of money. But he ended up losing, I think, 600 million from investing in Netflix. And on the flip side, Warren Buffett right now has just gone on a shopping spree and bought a lot of new stocks. He sold also a bunch of stuff. And it goes back to this story of whenever there's a downturn or whenever there's opportunities in the market, mostly the people who already have capital can invest or can take those kinds of risks. For the most part, if you don't have money during that time, you're not going to be able to basically invest or take advantage of the stock market. And this might just increase the wealth in inequality even further. I don't see how it's not basically a good system, but it also makes sense, and I don't see an alternative to it. So what do you think about rich people just buying even more assets now that they've become cheaper?
I think I wouldn't call I wouldn't try to make it rich people versus the small investors. To me, I think it's all about financial literacy, or I don't know, investment literacy, where people need to know that they shouldn't be driven by the current motives or the current sentiments or current emotions. Though you would argue that for an average person, whenever things are looking bad, they don't really have much money to survive on, so they would easily pull out their funds. And for the rich people, they have a lot of money to spare, so it's easy for them to now use that time to buy more. So actually, from that perspective, it makes sense that rich people will take advantage of this time to buy more. But generally, I think it's just a matter of knowing that you while you're investing, you shouldn't be so much driven by what's happening currently. For example, you know, the time when Dogecoin was almost at the peak, everyone was so excited and everyone was joining at that time. But people who are strategic about investments know that the best time to join in is when people are not yet very sentimental about it. And you know, you just play your cards right to make sure that you have some kind of seeing what you have some kind of method of projecting what might happen in the future, and then invest now instead of trying to invest right on the moment when you feel like people are not trying to invest in this thing. You should make the decision before, not at the time. So there is that, but yeah, the rich people have more spare money, so they can always invest more at the opportune time for them.
And you've also said something important there, which is that it's also about financial literacy. So as much as you're saying rich people versus poor people, or rich people and poor people, the information is out there. And using the internet, it's possible for anyone who is motivated enough, and if you find yourself in the right circumstances, to move from being a poor person to a rich person. And it also happens vice versa. So as much as there's classes, there's also the opportunities for individuals who are driven to, move up the ladder and also become the people who own those assets over time. It's something that's possible, and many people have done it, right?
Yeah, that's true. You'll find also a lot of retail investors actually using this period to increase their assets and investments. When looking at the index funds, it's important to know what the minimum requirement is because each fund has a minimum amount that you can invest. So those are some of the things you can look at, like minimum required investment and how much the fund managers charge.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so just to talk about that a bit, which is I think nowadays it's much easier to invest in something like the S&P 500. For example, if you download the FTX app, it was previously called Blockfolio. Nowadays, a lot of these stocks are tokenized, meaning you can buy 0.00001 shares, or you can divide it as much as you want. And so on the same app where you can buy crypto, you can also buy the S&P 500. You can also buy stocks, and it's just like in the click of a button, you as a retail investor have invested in the S&P 500, and you didn't have to talk to people like you didn't have to worry about minimums. You can buy like $5 in the S&P 500, and also you didn't have to pay anyone. You just have to invest in the stocks. What do you think about that? Is that like a convenient way of doing it?
Yeah, actually, I love the idea of the ETFs because now you can just buy any portion of it. You don't have to buy a whole amount of funds. So I think that's a real game changer. And I would actually prefer investing in that over going to a mutual fund.
Yeah, completely agree with you. Life is so easy nowadays. We live in the future, and it's very exciting for me. And just like, if you think of what's possible now with AI, with investing, with crypto, we're literally living in the future, and it's amazing. Even remote work and things like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, these are an interesting time to be alive. I agree with you.